You know, we've been building infrastructure for thousands of years. I guess the Chinese have been at it for 6,000 years, and we've been managing that infrastructure for just as long. So I don't look at this as a choice of getting into asset management. Well, we've been doing asset management for thousands of years. Maybe not been doing a very good job of it, given you know some of the issues we're dealing with here. But so I'm looking at this more as improving how we manage assets rather than making a choice to get into asset management. And as I look at the challenges, my task for today was to talk about infrastructure challenges. When I look at improving asset management, the infrastructure is actually the easy part. It's the institutional and the organizational challenges that are really the tough part. So Neil wanted me to use a case example. And so here's your council. You're making a choice on level of service. So here's your choice. You can have good roads for $2.5 million a year. You can have poor roads for $4 million a year. Which would you choose? Well, the right answer or the wrong answer, depending, this particular council, either by conscious choice, I don't think so, but anyhow, 20 or 30 or 40 years later, found themselves with poor and deteriorating roads, and they were investing $1 million a year. So obviously, it's not sustainable. So how could this happen? You got the people and processes. So is it the people who are bad? We've got bad politicians. We obviously don't have bad engineers. I've seen people that are sort of maybe a little bit narrower in their thinking because of the silo effects that we've been talking before. But I've yet to meet people that aren't really good people trying to do the best they can with what they've got. You know, I think the real issues are on the process side. And so if we look at poor information, we heard a lot from Gaetan's presentation here about the need for information. I don't know that we need more information. I think we need the right information. And I think we need to somehow translate that into knowledge. There's an awful lot of information out there, but translate it into knowledge for management. Poor integration? Absolutely. We've got the silo effects of engineering planning and so on. Poor communication? Again, for sure. Certainly poor communication going up to decision makers and into the operating ranks. Poor regulations, we'll hear a lot about kind of how the accounting system made us do it. And I think there's a fair amount of truth into that. Is also the whole process of doing, I think Wally mentioned it, capital versus operating budget rather than life cycle management. So there's a bunch of process issues that I think are really the focus of how to improve asset management. We all kind of know, and we've known for ages, that this is the characteristic curve for an asset's life cycle. So it's the old new car concept. You start out relatively new, it goes along, everything's doing fine, and then it starts to get a little more mature and costs a bit more to maintain. And then if you don't maintain it properly, you kind of fall off the cliff, and you know that it costs a lot to do reactive maintenance and so on. So if you look at how the normal process would be around infrastructure, so you're a public works guy going to council, you say, and this is actually from a case study I did for a community. You're going out there, you're saying, I need $315,000 per lane kilometer to build this road, and the O&M is $400 per lane kilometer. So that's where the budget's set. So you run along, if you go back to this diagram here, you run along on the plateau, and then all of a sudden the thing gets mature. And these are actual numbers that, again, came from the municipality's asset management system, what it costs to keep the thing in fair condition. So all of a sudden, public works guy goes to the finance guy, I said, I need $4,000 a lane kilometer now to maintain because I've gone past the point and I'm into fair. You know, so what does the finance director say? You need what? 10 times more budget? And so there's a bunch of hustling goes around, and typically you don't get the 10 times more budget, and there's a few compromises get made. And you start to see the picture going on here where you end up with a system where, for a whole variety of reasons, you end up with a suboptimal budget to meet the overall life cycle costs of the asset. And so whether by choice or just by sort of hazarding into it, the overall asset inventory of this particular community was basically going from good to bad to worse over time, because they didn't even have enough money in the system to keep the poor roads in poor condition. The system was basically falling apart. So they're operating way down on the cliff part of this, on the cliff part of this curve. So, I mean, does that kind of sound familiar to you as to how the system typically works? We know better, you know. So it's there's nothing about asset management that is really new. It's about how it gets bundled together and how it gets communicated. So where does PS3150 help? Well, I think Canadian Institute of Chartered Accountants put together a strategy back in 2002 that I thought was really good. And part of what came out of that was that a lot of stuff is, well, I guess it's over there with the engineers, and it's pretty complex, and we can't audit and be rigorous about it, so we'll do PS3150 as a good start. And I think that's what it is. It's a good start. It moves you from accrual, or moves you to accrual accounting versus cash accounting, and it gives you a number for depreciation based on a set of assumptions. And if you're a business, you would typically fund that. Right now, you don't have to fund it, as I understand it. But I think at some point, it obviously is going to have to be funded, or you, I guess, literally go into bankruptcy over time. So what are the challenges? Well, historical costs, it's an accounting. I mean, as it's structured right now, PS3150 is an accounting. It's financial accounting, not management accounting, I would look at it. And so we need to move towards management accounting. So historical cost just really doesn't cut it when it comes to what it actually costs you to replace assets. PS3150 doesn't look at operations and maintenance costs. It doesn't only looks at existing assets. It doesn't look at what your costs are for capacity expansions or for upgrades. If you've got to go to secondary or tertiary wastewater treatment, for example, that's not covered out of it. And I think really important, probably most importantly, it really doesn't do anything to promote efficiency and effectiveness. You know, that's the management part that's got to overlay on top of this. So if we look at life cycle costs beyond PS3150, so you're going along, and this is my accounting math or my engineering math, but you've got your $315,000 per lane kilometer. Break it out into two pieces, the surface and the base. Amortize the one over 45 years, one over 15 years. Let's assume that inflation is 5%. And let's assume that you actually are funding depreciation. You're putting the money in the bank and you're getting 5% interest on it. Then what happens? Well, you rehab the surface after 15 years. If all of those assumptions are right, you've got enough money out of the depreciation fund. Same thing at the next 15 years, so at the 30-year period. But surprise, surprise, you're not there when you come to reconstruct the road because you've used historical costs and your inflation has gone to the point where your reconstruction is $2.7 million and you've got roughly $700,000 in the kitty. So you've improved your accounting system, but your management processes are still challenged. So how do you get to sustainable funding? Well, there's really a couple of key ways. You can go budget-driven, and if you set a budget, then you can, in effect, move towards... you either sort of set a scope that's sustainable and affordable for a particular budget, or if you set a budget for a scope that's too big, which is in the case of the sample community, then you end up with degrading levels of service over time. If you go to needs-driven... then you back into a budget And chances are it's a budget that either you can't afford or people aren't willing to pay for. So ultimately, what this comes down to is, you know, the whole thing about sustainable funding is getting the right balance between what it is you want to buy in terms of quality of service and either what you're willing to pay for or what you can afford. And a lot of the, let's call it affordability studies I've done, shows that affordability typically isn't an issue, it's a willingness to pay issue. And so I think the bigger picture here is perhaps a political issue around around getting the willingness to pay, getting communication going, and increasing the willingness to pay. So what are the challenges to sustainable infrastructure? I say they're mostly institutional or organizational. I think the first thing is accepting that infrastructure is a business. It's a big business. Even if it's nonprofit, you're spending a lot of money, you're using a lot of resources, it should be run on business principles. You need to measure and report performance. That comes back to the accountability link and levels of service. You need to have a process that continuously improves your efficiency and your effectiveness, performance-driven. So as everybody here is talking about, you need a plan accountineer as a chief executive here. You need somebody who's got a bit of all of these things that can integrate all of the different disciplines. So we've heard a lot about setting target levels of service. I mean, these are just some samples. It really all starts with what quality of service it is that you want to provide and over what amount of area or how many people you want to serve. So these are just some samples here. 100% of water meets Canadian water guidelines. You've got water available, 98% a reliability criterion, and so on and so on. And at the end, I always find you got to link this right back to, if you're meeting all of those levels of service, what's the unit cost of service? And is that affordable, or are people willing to pay for it? If it's not, then go back to step one, and you keep cycling around that. And I think what's really important about bringing this back into a unit cost perspective, and this is where I think the business case for asset management comes, is that with asset management, you've got a lot of levers that you can maneuver to make things more effective or more efficient. I did a bunch of pro forma financial statements, about 25 or 30 year financial statements for a Chinese utility, and these are some of the results that came out of this. This was actually Metropolitan Guangzhou, the city in southern China. And so what we found here is that if we extended the average service life from 30 years to 40 years, in effect, we're extending depreciation from 2.5% to 3.5%, we could save about 5% off the bottom line. So that says if you're assuming a service life in PSAB of 25 years, because it says so in the book, through asset management, you can actually tweak that service life through good maintenance and material selection and whatever, and you can make money at it. If you extend debt amortization from 20 years to 40 years, I've never quite understood why you amortize 20-year debt for 70-year assets, for example. You know, there's a whole discussion around that. If we extended the amortization to 40 years, we got another 2% out of it. Just the way the numbers, the overlaying impacts, if we did both of those, we got 10% out of it. And so on and so on. If you reduce capital costs, if you reduce O&M costs. So it's not unrealistic, and I've got personal experience with this in running the wastewater utility, to get upwards of 15 or 20% off the bottom line. If you put that in the context of the national budget, roughly $5 billion a year. It's actually more than the federal provincial infrastructure program collectively. So, good management practice can put an awful lot of money on your bottom line, and it moves you to a sustainable approach to management to boot. So, how to put all this stuff together? This is how I typically characterize pulling together an asset management plan, and there's 10-step boxes or whatever. But you start with your asset register with all the information about the assets. go through failure analysis. And that's not only looking at physical failure, but looking at capacity failure and so on, like failure to have enough capacity. Go through all these steps through risk analysis, through optimization of financial, operating capital. And then you end up with an asset management plan. So if we look at what are the kind of information that you need here? And I guess the first thing I would stress is the old keep it simple, stupid approach here, is that, Gaetan mentioned, don't get buried in information. I think the key thing here is collecting the right information and just enough information to give you what you need to manage what you want to manage. And so that's where starting out with the levels of service, typically that's where you start. Those are the things that you want to manage. So you should be building your business processes and your data and so on to support those kinds of things and your accounting structure to support that. So the asset register, for each asset you'd have a bunch of physical information as we've got up here. Risk, we'll talk a little bit later here about business risk exposure ratings, but each asset should have a business risk exposure ranking. A whole bunch of O&M information, your maintenance history, your breakdown history, and so on should be in your asset inventory. You should have a bunch around capacity, what your design capacity is, what your current loads on the system are, what your projected demand for service is. And then a bunch of costs around construction costs, replacement costs, O&M costs, and asset value. So you get the sense that this becomes a major repository of information that supports all of the management decision processes. So the next thing is projecting service demand. As Wally said earlier on, you don't need an asset if you don't have a customer. So how many customers are you going to have, and what kind of service do you need to provide? So again, for each asset, you know what your design capacity is. You've got people flows, whatever, however you measure it, trip times with cars. You then measure what your current service demand is, and that's an ongoing measurement process. You then need to project your service demands, and that comes out of whatever your community plans are, your history of demand, a whole bunch of different ways that you can come at that. And then project your demands and then look at demand management impacts. And ultimately, you come up with a demand curve that you have to supply in some fashion, and that gives you, in effect, a demand curve for your capital and when you're likely going to have to replace or upgrade an asset. And that's one plug for your overall financial plan. Projecting physical failure. A lot of this is just getting down to collecting condition information, breakdown history information, monitoring trends in condition and breakdowns, looking at what the impact of different types of interventions have been. If you've gone in and put, for example, cathodic protection on pipelines or whatever, how has that affected the deterioration curves? And then at the end, having projected deterioration curves for each of the assets that will then likewise give you estimated costs and timing for when either upgrades or replacement is going to have to be done. Monitoring efficiency. You need to have processes, including benchmarking, in place that you know whether what you're doing is being done efficiently. So obviously you've got to collect plan and current costs for O&M, look at the trends in those. Again, look at what the impact of interventions are, improving maintenance program. Reactive maintenance is always a lot more expensive than preventative or planned maintenance. So, what's the impact of shifting maintenance practices? Again, you need to project your trends in O&M costs. And as we saw with the case example before, you know that over time, even with good practices, your O&M costs or your particular maintenance costs are going to go up to some degree. It's a matter of managing to optimize them. And then you end up out of all of this with a, through a life cycle analysis of a particular asset, you want to look at, we talk about failure due to economic inefficiency. If an asset just becomes too costly to maintain versus replace or rehab it, then that drives a capital expenditure or capital project. So you need to be using all your maintenance, your O&M information on a routine basis to do a life cycle analysis around O&M, rehab, replace, those kind of decisions to produce your financial projections. Asset value, you need to, I think, on a regular basis be updating your replacement costs in your asset register. This can be done. I know a number of organizations do that, for example, through the results coming out of their contracting. They'll go back and look at, update the unit costs based on current contract information so that all of the unit cost drivers for the replacement cost stuff is kept up to date on a regular basis. It can be done with cost indices or, however you do it. Projected versus planned service life. Again, I think this needs to be something that you start out with an assumption. But as we saw with the financial analysis, you can really change your efficiency by stretching that service life through good practice. So you want to continually update that service life based on your actual operating conditions, your maintenance records, and so on. And then you would go in and adjust the depreciation assumptions. If you've assumed that the curve will go like that, and in fact it can be flatter, then one would hope that you could go back in and adjust your depreciation assumptions because you're obviously not consuming the asset as much as you expected to, and there can be some cost savings on the bottom line come out of that. So then you would adjust your financial projections. The risk register should be in place for each single asset, and even at the component level of assets. For example, you might find that the control system of a pumping station is the Achilles heel. So, the risk has to go right down to the managed maintenance item within a facility, so that you're looking at the probability consequence of failure around each of the key components. And so you end up with a risk score that's essentially probability of failure, consequence of failure times redundancy. You would then rank the risks in terms of those scores. That provides the basis for cost-benefit analysis around what is the benefit of doing risk mitigation strategies. If something has a relatively high probability but a low consequence, you say, well, I'll just wait till it fails and I'll fix it. If it has a relatively high probability and a high consequence, then you may want to be looking at putting some kind of redundancy or mitigation. That's where you might get into twinning major pipelines, for example, or having dual force mains if it's a major issue. So again, your risk strategy would drive what some of your project requirements are going to be. Redundancy? Okay. Use the example where you've got a dual pipeline. So if you have two side-by-side pipelines and each have the same capacity and one fails, then you have 100% redundancy. Because if that pipeline fails, you can still deliver the service. If the second pipeline has only 50% of the capacity, then you have to make a decision of whether 50% of the capacity is enough. Maybe only half the customers won't get service. If that's the case, then you get 50% redundancy. But if only having 50% in effect means that you've got no service, then you've got no redundancy. So it's just looking at to what extent can you continue to deliver service if a particular asset or a component fails. It reduces the consequences. Okay? Because what happens, but the redundancy basically reduces the consequences, because we're saying if the asset fails, then you stop service. But if you have another asset that can continue some or all of that service, then all of the consequences of the failure don't happen. So that's where the redundancy reduces the consequences. So this is where you do the business cases around, I've just done a risk analysis for Terrace, the gas transmission company. And obviously some of the consequences there get pretty severe. So they look at twinning, duplicating pipelines and so on to try to mitigate some of those risks. So in amongst all this, you've set the levels of service. So you obviously want to be measuring your performance against that. So your ongoing management, your day-to-day activity monitoring processes would be measuring your actual performance against each of these levels of service. And obviously the difference between where you want to be and where you're actually at generates gaps. And that in itself generates a needs-based work program. So in the end, you parcel all of this stuff up, and you'll see most of the stuff I've been talking about is kind of in one or other of these boxes, and you bundle all that up into producing an asset management plan. And actually, I look at an asset, when I do the asset management plans, they're essentially a business plan for the infrastructure. So it's incorporating the technical, financial, organizational, and whatever aspects related to asset management. So then you bundle all that stuff into projecting, doing your financial projections. And so typically you'd look at projected income. And here, when I say you're doing the financial projections, I think particularly with the PSAB structure now, I think it would be good to carry, in essence, multi-year projections for all three of the financial statements. So the balance sheet, the income statement, cash flow statement, produce pro formas for each of those so that there's a direct link back into the financial records. But, so you would project your income. And, I mean, that's where you'd look at what you've got tax income, you've got user fees, whatever income is coming into the utilities. In China, they used to run restaurants. Whatever out of the wastewater utility. There's a bunch of non-operating revenues, but I'm not so sure that's so common here. Then you got to project the capital expenditures, not only the total amounts, but the cash flows. It's important to know where the cash flows are occurring. Project your O&M expenditures, and then build your financing plan. And that's where you got to figure out how much debt, what type of debt, what terms your debt is going to be, and that's got to plug in. And then you project your multi-year financial statements. And at the end of that, you'll end up with, for all of the stuff you've bundled in there, some unit cost of service. And I'd encourage you to get it down to a unit cost of service of some kind. In the water wastewater business, it's quite easy because you get it down to dollars per cubic meter of wastewater treated or water produced. There's probably dollars per lane kilometer or trip or whatever, but get it down to a unit cost of service. Now, in this case, it's actually the cash flows out. So this includes debt charges and any. So it's not actually the total cost. It's not the capital cash flows. It would be the debt charges if you're debt financing, for example. So this is including all of the capital charges, the operating charges, and so on. So the deal here is that you play the levers until effectively you get a match. And that, as we said, ends up being a balance ultimately between what it is you want to buy and either what you want to pay for it or what you're willing to pay. And I think the kind of a process we're talking about here and the information that you've got really helps you to sit in with negotiations with the elected officials or go to the public and get hopefully a more informed choice than our case city did, going back when. So that when you pick a level of service, you pick it on the basis of what your long-term life cycle costs are going to be, so that there's really no surprises when somebody shows up and says, the maintenance budget has to go up because the infrastructure is deteriorating. So what's the conclusions out of this? Well, PS 3150 is not about sustainable infrastructure. So, you know, if we're focused on meeting 3150 as an infrastructure solution, we're kind of going the wrong way. You know, PS 3150 is a plug of the whole jigsaw puzzle. So asset management, it's a way of doing business. We don't have a choice about getting into asset management. We are in asset management. It's about how well we want to do asset management. I think one of the key thing here is integrating the planning, operations, and finance. It seems to be a repeated theme that's going through. Got to break down the traditional silos. You need to balance level of service with affordability. And I'd overlay onto that. It's not affordability. It's willingness to pay, actually. So there's got to be more effort done, I think, at the willingness to pay side. And you need a knowledge-driven process that has the right data and just enough data to inform all of the business processes that you've set up. So Neil asked me to give you some suggestions on how to actually go about implementing. And I think the first thing you do is enroll for the BCIT course that's coming up on April 19th. We're starting the first L of our executive MBA style course at BCIT on that. But anyhow, that's a plug. I think the first thing is you got to break the cycle somehow. And I think the first thing you got to do, in my mind, is put whoever is running the infrastructure, put them in charge of the finances and the operations of the entire business, single source accountability and responsibility. I think the finance function still has a statutory accounting and a treasury function to do for the community, but I don't think you can continue to say the finance people are looking after the money and the operations people are looking after the operations, because you can't do the one without the other. I had that discussion with GVRD, and I ended up being the only manager taking my budgets to councils and so on, and with the finance manager supporting me rather than the finance manager presenting the budgets. That actually worked quite well for the organization, I think. I think you need to start. I'm a great believer in starting simply and then expanding. And I say, I think a big part of this is institutional restructuring. It's not about data. It's not, you know, and so I think it's easy just to go off and start collecting more and more and more data. The hard part is you got to deal with the institutional structure. And so when I did this, I literally got my superintendents and the key management people in a room. I put an asset management plan together based on all the institutional knowledge within a matter of days. And it was like, in effect, turning the tanker around. We made the decision to go in a different direction. We got the direction set. That gave us the starting point to start going to politicians, and it gave us the starting point to know where we were strong, where we were weak, and really target the information gathering and so on to strengthen the process over time. Do a first cut asset management plan. I'd encourage you to just get out there and put one together and see what it looks like and actually start to use it. And as Wally said, you know, this is not something that sits off here. It's actually the day-to-day operating plan for whoever the director of public works or whatever it is. So it's the thing that gets thumbed and really impacts all of the decisions in the organization. Start with some levels of service. They may be wrong, but start somewhere, and then start to drive, measure, and start to drive your business on levels of service. And just by getting started, you'll start to build the culture in the organization. And it'll be like the snowball. It'll cascade over time. And in my experience, when I did this with Greater Vancouver with the sewer utility back in 1990-91, we were so far away from where we needed to be sustainable. My deal with the board was If you buy in here, that'll set the direction. And we know that we're wrong to a large extent. But we know that even from here, if we're operating at this point, we need to be up here. So it'll take years to get to there. So over time, we'll refine, we'll close the deal, and we'll optimize the system. So that's what they did. We started simply, and then we just refined it over time. Well, I mean, that's the question here is how do you go about ranking projects and making choices? Well, coincidentally, one of the first things I had to do when I went to China was developing an investment planning and priority setting process for the World Bank and for the city of Tianjin, and the approach I took at that point was again starting off with levels of service, and I say we talk about capital and operating dollars. I think that we only have money, you know, in the end. So it's how do you best use money? So I set up, and I think this is the right way to do it, is to you start with your levels of service, and your levels of service need to be in the three accounts: social, environmental, and economic. So you need to have levels of service that are, and that should tie back into your community plan as well. So you've got those levels of service are set. You should have at least one or two levels of service for each of those three, three buckets, if you like. Then you've got measures. You've got performance measures and definitions around those performance measures for each of those levels of service. Then you do the measurement. And then you do the gap analysis around are you achieving the target or not. So then when you come down to then really everything that you should be doing, I think, as an organization is either striving to keep on performance or restoring performance. So then that performance gap and those levels of service give you the basis for your business case and your decision framework. So you would business case whether it's an operations activity or a capital project or a policy or whatever in terms of its impact of changing, improving performance. So it would be a dollars per unit of improvement of performance. And so you then get, in effect, a cost-benefit score you use the business risk score as identifying what your high risks are, and then you would cost benefit risk strategies like you would any other.
Yeah, so that would fit into the finance piece.
That's right, because again, typically the risks, the consequences of failure, are around environmental, social, and economic. You know, so because again, when you're doing the risk analysis, you need to have the consequence of failure categories in each of those as well. So that the whole thing links up into a system.
All right. With that, thank you very much, Hugh.
All right.